Welcome to Curated Conversations from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, bringing you the best events each week from the world's number one defense and national security think tank. To explore the hundreds of events we host each year, visit us at csis.org.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Mark Bellamy, and I'm a senior advisor for Africa here at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And I have the very agreeable duty this morning of introducing our distinguished guest and of moderating the discussion that will follow his remarks. But before doing that, I wanted to frame a little bit this morning's discussion. First of all, it's great to see such a big audience here today. This event was quickly oversubscribed, so I apologize to those who were not able to get in. This event will be webcast and I suppose archived, so that's an alternative. And I know that many of you here today, probably everybody.
Welcome to Curated Conversations from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, bringing you the best events each week from the world's number one defense and national security think tank. To explore the hundreds of events we host each year, visit us at csis.org.
In this room, understand well Kenya's importance, both in Africa and globally. And I know that you probably understand equally well why Kenya matters and has for so long mattered to the United States. And high among the reasons Kenya has mattered to the United States is the commitment of so many ordinary Kenyans to democratic governance, however perfect it may be, at a time when so many other nations are drifting towards authoritarianism and strongman rule. We saw that popular commitment again in the August 8 elections in Kenya, when Kenyans voted massively for a president, members of parliament, governors, and county-level representatives. But now, in the aftermath of that election and of the Supreme Court-ordered rerun of the presidential election October 26, Kenya is in political disarray. A sizable part of Kenya, perhaps half the population, does not accept the legitimacy of the presidential rerun. I suspect, however, that those rejecting the October 26th rerun may have a hard time convincing the courts and international opinion that a third election offers the best way out of this crisis. Pressure is growing in Kenya and internationally to get beyond this cycle of protested elections. Yet just moving on, as some demand, could well make Kenya's problems worse. Kenyans today are more bitterly divided along partisan lines than at any time since the violence of 2008. And that's not a very good basis for just moving on. Right Honorable Raila Odinga is well known to this audience. He is one of the great figures of Kenya's post-independence political history. He was denied the presidency in a deeply flawed presidential election in 2007. Many believe he was denied the presidency again in a controversial election in 2013. Kenya's Supreme Court, however, ruled otherwise, and Honorable Odinga, in a remarkable act of statesmanship, called upon his supporters to accept the court's verdict and move on, and they did. In this year's presidential election, many of Mr. Odinga's supporters believe he was again rigged out, as the Kenyans say. Proving that deep suspicion will not be easy. What is not in doubt is that this presidential election, like elections in 2013 and 2008, failed to deliver a credible enough result to the Kenyan people. All of this is background. Going forward, big questions loom about the future of Kenya's democracy. How does Kenya exit this crisis without falling into the trap of simply moving on? How can current tensions be transformed into a movement for genuine reform of Kenya's political culture, including its electoral practices? And what must be done to bridge Kenya's widening partisan and ethnic divide? There are no good answers to these questions without the strong imprint of Honorable Raila Odinga. And so it's my great pleasure to welcome him today to CSIS.
Thank you, Mark. And I can see so many familiar friends here. But shall I say that distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, good morning.
Good morning.
I am very delighted to have an opportunity once again to come back and talk to an audience in the CSIS time. As I mentioned, I'm seeing so many familiar faces. I see Ambassador Johnny Carson here. I've got Salim Lawn. I see Keith on the other side. So many faces here. So I want to feel that I'm among friends. I say that democratic and secure and stable African future can only be attained through the power of ideas and candid informed debate, and that is always plentiful in this house. Your continuing commitment to Africa is a blessing for the continent and for the US too. I'm very glad to be here with so many close friends, as I mentioned. I think you take Ambassador Bellamy here and Ambassador Johnny Carson are two occurring U.S. ambassadors that Kenya ever had, and subsequently the two most astute ambassadors Kenya has in the U.S. The distinguished guests here attest to the recognition of Kenya as one of the most strategically important nations in Africa. I was told that the hall was fully booked nearly a week ago, and that there were quite a number of people who wanted to attend today but were not able to get access to this room. That again attest to the importance that Kenya attracts here in the U.S. Despite its relatively small economy, Kenya has played an outsized role in the continent leadership because of its half a century long stability. That stability also coexisted with vast democratic deficits, which was successfully fought for by a lengthy, painful, but always peaceful struggle for greater freedoms. That is what brought us the extraordinary democratic and economic transformations few in Africa have achieved. We were a safe haven from which concerned international partners could tackle all the crises that racked virtually every one of our neighbors over the decades. So what I'm saying here is that what we have in Kenya did not just come on its own, that it was a result of a lengthy historical struggle by the people of Kenya to improve the standard and quality of life of our people. It has been a struggle between two diametrically opposed forces. The forces for the retention of the status quo, also the forces for change and reform, democratization, which has taken different forms throughout our 55 years of independence. But it has been very consistent. These achievements help us maintain not just peace, but an exceptional level of innovation and entrepreneurship that is renowned around the world. Thanks to our people's openness in embracing global currents, as well as our vibrant civil society and media. Our partners, too, have played a crucial role in our great gains and in stabilizing our country when disasters occurred or threatened to occur. But all of this progress is being imperiled through our current crisis, the most long-lasting Kenya has ever endured. The world must not be deceived that this is merely an electoral crisis triggered by the third straight rigged election. The crisis is all-encompassing and has resulted from the attempt to unlawfully hold on to power. It threatens to undo everything we have achieved and tearing apart our democratic and inter-ethnic fabric. Let me be blunt. Kenya is hurtling towards an outright dictatorship. The Jubilee government has ridden roughshod over or looted every institution that they could in order to achieve their goal of long-term control of the state, or at least till their self-declared goal of ruling till at least 2032. You're too far. Let me put my thing better. The regime has targeted and inflicted particularly severe damage and two institutions that are central to the preservation of democracy and peace through the delivery of free, fair, and credible elections. That is, the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission and the Supreme Court of Kenya. These two critical institutions have been targeted through nothing less than a reign of terror. The Electoral Commission was comprehensively undermined before the August elections. The assault on the Supreme Court began after the courageous Chief Justice David Maraga and his fellow justices astounded Kenyans and the world by annulling that election of President Uhuru Kenyatta for pervasive irregularities and illegalities. This was not just a historic ruling in Kenya, but in Africa. And it is just the fourth time that an election of a president had been overturned in the world. So it was a trend-setting decision on the African continent. Among the other great setbacks for Kenya in the current crisis has been the disappointing role of our partners who are with us in the decisive struggle for multi-party democracy in the early 1990s. They also intervened with the lightning speed during our catastrophe a decade ago when mass violence erupted after the tainted 2007 elections. Kenya matters, or at least it did then. In this crisis, though, the US and other pro-democracy friends chose to avert their gaze from the unfolding electoral lawlessness and continued against all the evidence to support a deeply tainted electoral process. To give the most recent example, Commission Chairman Wafula Chebukati courageously confessed that his electoral commission was driven by politically motivated pressures and that he could not guarantee a free and fair elections on the 26th of October rerun. That was 8 days to the election day. The chairman publicly on a live television said he was not able to deliver a free and fair elections on that date. Before that, a commissioner had resigned and also cited reasons why she thought that elections cannot be free and fair. But in a stand that astounded Kenyans and Western envoys, Western envoys 2 days later announced that they believed the commission could hold a credible poll and supported that highly controversial election. It was an utter bizarre blur sight. What we asked, they said, which had changed. The chairman is saying he cannot deliver free and fair elections. The envoys are coming up and saying everything is clear. You will go ahead and participate in these elections. I say that if really these are true friends of Kenya, then Kenya does not need any enemies. You don't need enemies. But I'm convinced all is not lost yet. What Kenyans are asking is something small, a fresh, credible election. Numerous independent institutions, as well as international media, previously supportive of Uhuru Kenyatta's government, had strongly opposed the holding of that election. This nearly universal stance has vindicated NASA's position that a credible election is the only option Kenya has to give peace a chance, and even more important, heal a nation that has been torn into angry bits. But holding such an election needs a radically changed, non-confrontational environment in which the two sides can campaign on the basis of what they offer Kenyans for a better future. I have come to Washington to convey a simple message, which we need. To convey a simple message. We need a much fuller engagement from the many arms of governance that your country possesses to assist the envoys based in Nairobi. The envoys' efforts up to now have not succeeded in defusing the crisis. But let me be blunt again, they have sometimes contributed to the problem. Despite the grave challenges, I see glimmers of hope from the events of the past few days. Kenyans were very pleased that the US and other friends refused to congratulate Mr. Kenyatta after the Electoral Commission announced that he had been elected president, after an election more woefully tainted than the annulled August one. A solution must be found in Kenya soon. Each day this crisis continues, the divisions, polarization, and radicalization deepen. The killings of unarmed protesters by police, including infants and children shot inside their homes, and the severe financial hardships being inflicted upon millions by the currently paralyzed economy are adding to the tinder. The most inflammatory recent development, with the Supreme Court being prevented from convening to hear the case about whether the 26th October rerun election should be held. But the evening before, the Deputy Chief Justice Philomena Mwilu's bodyguard was shot and grievously wounded. That sent shockwaves, and the court immediately asked for increased protection from the police. When that request was turned down, a number of justices did not feel safe to travel to the court, resulting in the lack of required quorum. In which other democratic country has the Supreme Court been prevented from hearing a case this way? What I call the reign of terror against the Supreme Court and the Electoral Commission began with the torture and murder of Mr. Chris Musando, the Commission's chief technology responsible for the integrity of the entire voting system. This is 1 week before the elections. The gentleman who was in charge of the ICT at the Electoral Commission was abducted, tortured, and murdered. That was to send signals to everybody that the government would broker no nonsense and let all of the people in the commission were compliant. The FBI offered to assist through the US government, offered to put FBI at disposal to carry out investigations. And the British government offered Scotland Yard. The government rejected the kind of assistance. They said they had the capacity. Why? Because they knew that they themselves were the culprits. Kenyans know that the decades-long struggle for justice and our grand new constitutional order was waged and won peacefully. That is why NASA's leadership is centered on a campaign of peaceful resistance to unlawfully constituted authority. You have convened a people's assembly to guide the country to a fresh, free, and fair presidential election as decreed by the Supreme Court. What we have said is that we don't want violence in our country, but these matters can be solved peacefully. And we said that we are going to carry out peaceful protests to put pressure on the government to ensure that there is a proper open democratic elections. And those instruments include peaceful demonstrations, they include strikes, they include picketing, include boycotts, include petitioning, and so on. What has been unfortunate is that the government has responded very violently to peaceful demonstrations organized by the people, where innocent people, women, and children have been shot and killed. That record of anti-democratic criminal behavior, which has included systematic measures limiting civil society and media protections, have made many wonder how our long-standing democratic partners have not publicly spoken up against these depredations. Most of us worry that this is a result of international policies that exclusively focus on security and stability, and that the envoys in Nairobi believe only President Kenyatta can deliver this own force and security first agenda. When that agenda is accompanied by a government's increasing authoritarianism and plans to stay permanently in power, Kenya's historic stability is at a fundamental risk. An anti-democratic culture in a freedom-loving country like Kenya is a recipe for radicalization and extremism. I'm saying that there seems to be an obsession with so-called stability stability and fight against extremism. That stability takes precedence over democracy. That if a regime is able to provide stability and support in the fight against extremism and fundamentalism, then one doesn't even care about how they're managing their own internal affairs. This seems to more or less mirror the Cold Era period, where the war was against communism. And so long as UK say that you are an ally of the West in war against communism, nobody cared how you ran your affairs. You got all the standard support and assistance you needed. That's how we created Mobutu Sese Seke's of Africa, Idi Amin Dada's, Jean Bedel Bokassa of Central African Republic, Wazi Kamuzu Banda of Malawi. So these people were able to come and take shelter under the war against communism. These days now, the war is against terrorism. And so now the cover is stability and ally in the war against terrorism. And therefore, in this process, democracy is the casualty. That campaign and war against extremism and terrorism is pivotal in our time, in our region. But to succeed, it must begin within each of our countries by building a state that shuns sectarianism and makes inclusion and equity at its core values. And the biggest problem in Kenya right now is exclusion. Exclusion is a bigger issue. And when you see people begin to talk about secession or wanting out of Project Kenya, it basically tells you that something is seriously wrong with Kenya that must be addressed and before the country tears apart. In the last decade or last century, we saw countries disintegrate. Where the former Soviet Union, so many republics, the former Czech Republic, Czechoslovakia, the former Yugoslavia, has now so many different countries out of it. So this, these problems come about as a result of exclusion within a society. Unless they are addressed, they will tear the country apart. You see right now in Spain, the Catalonia issue is a big issue. And you've seen in Kenya people beginning to talk about wanting to secede. These are symptoms of a problem that must be addressed. Too many African leaders just assess where Western governments stand and align their security policies. As things stand now, anger and radicalization is growing by the day. And unless this election crisis is expeditiously ratified, Kenya could be rendered incapable of protecting its own and its partners' fundamental interests. The depth of this crisis can be seen in the hitherto unheard of phenomenon of mainstreaming Kenya's feeling so deeply excluded that they are openly toying with the idea of secession. The rascals will always be thrown out by the people. But it does not seem that the path to sustainable security is an impossible one, for a regime which is essentially composed of a powerful elite, which has been at our country's helm for the last 55 years. In addition, our four presidents have come from only two communities, and the next one preparing to take over after Uhuru is not from one of the other 42 communities either. As I said at the outset, these ills coexist extraordinarily and accomplishment by talented, hardworking, and outward-looking Kenyans. Kenya's future, and indeed Africa's, lies in democracy. Both the regime and our traditional partners must retrace their steps and accept that the current state of affairs endangers the nation, the region, and the security and stability of the entire world. We, as Kenya, in conclusion, have played a very central role in the eastern part of Africa. The problems that face Kenya are not unique to Kenya. You can say that the problems that are found in many other African countries. From the periods of the Cold War, when then the wind of change began to blow on the African continent, it brought down the single party and multi-party and military dictatorships. And multi-partyism became the vogue. With the advent of multi-partyism, competition came into the political system. And African economies, which had been dormant, some of them realizing negative growth, most of them were hippies, highly indebted economists, began to register higher rates of economic growth because of competition and openness. This is what happened in the later, in the last decade of the last century, and also the first decade of this century. Unfortunately, in the second decade, you've been seeing a tendencies of revision or reversion of this trend. The old order is beginning to fight back on the continent. You're seeing the single one-man syndrome leadership begin to come back. You've seen a revision of constitutions. Term limits are being revised to open it up. Again, you begin to see the strongman syndrome, Monsieur le Président, reemerge on the African continent, and then breaking of the checks and balances on the continent. And then the electoral autocracy is also creeping in. Elections are being held as rituals that must be held every 4 or 5 years. But then they must be won by the incumbent at every cost. So when this happens, of course, apathy sets in. People no longer get interested in participating in elections. So you find situations where 10 to 20% of the population participate in elections, and the incumbent then gets 90% or 99% of those votes cast. Because this is not healthy for African democracy. So democracy must be universal. And we believe that Africans do not deserve lower standards. That democracy must be universal. And those who say that, oh, it is not good enough, but it is Africa. If it happened in Europe, it would not be acceptable, or in Americas. We think that that time is gone, that we must apply the same standard in Africa that we apply in terms of democracy in other parts of the continent and part of the world. This is the belief of the African Democrats and those of us
who believe truly that Africa deserves better, that Africa can be better governed, and that Africa and a stronger Africa is a better partner for the international community than an unstable Africa, which is being mismanaged and misgoverned by autocrats. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. The podium disappeared quickly. Is this microphone on? Can you hear me? All right. Okay. All good. Well, thank you. Thank you, Honorable Odinga. I know there's a great deal of interest in this room in talking about the issues that you've raised in your speech and talking about perhaps other issues as well. We have about 45 minutes, so we have ample time to do that. There will be microphones circulating. I would just ask that those of you who would like to pose a question or make a comment, first please identify yourself. I would like to, if I could, start the discussion here perhaps by asking you a couple of questions, perhaps more focused on the way forward, on where does Kenya go from here? I think one could make an argument that presidential elections are looking increasingly like a perilous exercise, a perilous experiment in Kenya. We've had three presidential elections since 2007, each one controversial, each one tense, each one where public fears of violence were elevated, and each one at the end where it cannot be said that Kenyans as a whole were satisfied. In fact, each of these elections resulted in Kenyans being perhaps more polarized than they were before the vote. I want to, I guess, ask a question that has to do with what you proposed following the rerun, the presidential rerun, which was the formation of a national resistance movement. And this, as I understand it, has several components, among them an economic boycott, the formation of a people's assembly, and some other aspects. Can you tell us, Honorable Odinga, what do you hope to obtain through this national resistance movement? Are you hoping to have the election results annulled and go to fresh elections? Are you hoping to perhaps put in place some form of interim government for a period of time? Or is this national resistance movement mainly a way of keeping a sizable part of the Kenyan population alert and mobilized? What are your aims?
Well, I think it's much more broader than just presidential elections. We've come to realize that the issue is not just a presidential election. Because as you know, the last time we went to court to challenge the outcome, and in the process of that court hearing, a lot of other details emerged of what had happened, not just with presidential elections, but across the board, the gubernatorial, the senatorial, even the members of parliament. There was a blatant rigging. For example, the Jubilee Party enjoys artificial majority in the Senate, the National Assembly, and so on. But all this was designed through an algorithm put in the system so that it could justify the rigging across board. Now, the courts
identified what they call illegalities and irregularities, which they directed the Electoral Commission to rectify before they did a repeat presidential poll. We came out after that with a 12-point document. She says the 12-point reducible minimum that needed to be done by the Electoral Commission before they could do the fresh poll. They ignored and refused to address those issues. So as time was ticking, we decided that it was going to be like doing the same thing, the same way, expecting different results. So we decided that we will not do it. That's why we pulled out of the race. Even if the Supreme Court now declares the vote again null and void, because what happened was when we were not the candidate, we wrote to the Electoral Commission and we pulled out. They still insisted in having our names in the ballot. And plus the other candidates. So there were 8 candidates in the ballot. As it were, I still beat the other 8 candidates. Though I was not a candidate. But as you can see, there was still a logarithm. When the president votes were 1 million, mine was 10,000. When he was 2 million, mine was 20,000. 3 million, 30,000. 7.4 million, mine was 73,000. So it was something that was already predetermined and all put in the system. Okay? Because first I said it was Uhuru running. So it was Uhuru running against Kenyatta. Then after that, when Uhuru had beaten Kenyatta, then now it became Uhuru versus the turnout. Because the turnout was low, it had to be beefed up. So they went on again now, beefing up the turnout. So you just look at it and saying, according to official kits, because people are being identified biometrically, only 3.5 million people voted. But officially, they gave the figures 7.4 million. So if they even were rigging for him when he was running alone, how about if I was running against him? So that's why we're saying that the problem is bigger than this. We need to first address the issue of how do you reform the Electoral Commission? How do you change the Electoral Commission before you can go for another rerun of the presidential elections? Secondly, the other issues are the system of devolution. See, we had a constitution which had been properly debated and agreed upon in 2005. But this constitution was not popular with the executive. It was not presented to parliament. They went to court and got an injunction. And then they bastardized it. It was then rejected in a referendum. In 2010, they were taken and they did a grafting. They were not comfortable with the chapters on devolution, the chapters on the executive. So a grafting was done. The original one, which was discussed and approved, was a hybrid system with a presidency and also a premier, the French system model. And then the devolution was also bigger units. But because they did not want devolution, they came up with tiny unit. So you've got 47 different counties, each with the governors, on a population of 45 million. Nigeria, on the other hand, with 155 million population, has only got 36 states. South Africa has only got 10 provinces. The same thing with Mozambique. So we think that the chapter on devolution need to be revisited, as well as the structure of the executive. That is why we are calling for a people's assembly that is bigger than just the national parliament. So we have set up the National Resistance Movement as a way of applying pressure so that we can be able to create the People's Assembly, similar to the Bomas Constitutional Conference, mm-hmm. that will enable us to put these matters back on the table, to have them debated and agreed on before we can move forward further. This is the purpose. So the National Resistance Movement is the one that is actually managing these protests, like, for example, demonstrations, like, for example, boycotts. Right now, there's a motion which is being debated in various county assemblies. It was already approved yesterday by two county assemblies. Today it's being debated in three other county assemblies. So the more the merrier, the more county assemblies approve it, the better for us. So then each county assembly will nominate delegates to the People's Assembly, which will then begin to debate these issues. How do we strengthen, how do we reform the Electoral Commission? How do we secure the independence of the judiciary, which is threatened right now? How do we reform their security forces so that they're not used to kill innocent children? Then how do we deal with the issue of the devolution and the structure of the executive? Mm.
So if I understand you correctly, the National Resistance Movement and the People's Assembly that comes out of that really has long-range goals,
Yes.
comprehensive political reforms.
Right.
This is not necessarily connected to whether you have an election, you know, an election rerun. Mm. This is a longer-term project.
Right.
Let me ask in that context. Some have said that, well, perhaps what Honorable Odinga, or perhaps what the NASA leadership, the NASA supporters are really want is an interim government, a power-sharing arrangement similar to what you had after the 2007 elections and the 2008 violence. While I think it's hard to imagine that President Kenyatta, the Jubilee government, would accept such an arrangement, is that part of your thinking? Do you think that may be formation somehow of an interim government might be a way forward?
See, the way things stand right now, Kenyatta's term ended on the 1st of this month. That is because the Supreme Court had given an extension of just 60 days from the ruling, which was on the 1st of September. So up to 1st of November. Beyond that now, he does not have a mandate at all. So what you're saying is that whatever happens with the Supreme Court ruling, because there's already there are petitions before the Supreme Court right now, whatever it rules, you're saying we need to have now an interim arrangement, an interim arrangement very similar to what happened in South Africa.
Mm.
It between the de Klerk and the ANC, where both sides would appoint a team to manage matters in an interim basis and to ensure that these changes take place before any meaningful elections could be held. That's what I was suggesting.
Let me just ask one final question before opening this up to our audience. You put together a you and your colleagues put together a rather remarkable coalition last year, the National Super Alliance, which gathered together some top tier political figures and a number of different communities in Kenya, and many believed that broad-based support, that broad-based coalition, might be able to propel you to an electoral victory. There have been some signs that this coalition may be growing weary, and that some members are, that the unity which you'd built is fraying a bit. How do you see the near-term future of NASA? How strong do you think the organization is going to be, and what are the maybe some of the forces that are working to perhaps lessen some of the unity that you'd built up before?
You see, NASA basically brought in a very broad-based coalition. It cut across the entire country. We have the top about four political movements. This is the Orange Democratic Movement, the WIPAP Democratic Movement, the ANC, the Amani National Congress, and then the Ford Kenya, the Forum for Restoration Democracy. So these parties putting together basically represent all sections of our country, all regions, and brought very comprehensive leadership, unlike our competitor Jubilee, which is basically a two-region affair. And it is also evidence in terms of the voting pattern in the country. You'll see that NASA gets support from almost all regions of the country. But there are areas where Jubilee does not get any votes from. So we think that if we have these two teams working together, then you'll have the entire country represented. Because what I'm saying is that it is the exclusion, which is, I think, one of the primary problems affecting the country today. You see, for example, the governors from the coast region, all the members of parliament from the coast region, members of the county assemblies, met last week. And made an announcement that they want to take steps to secede from Kenya, which is, of course, a very dangerous statement. But it is basically because of frustrations that people feel. These are things that can no longer be swept under the carpet. They must be addressed.
Well, thank you for that. I'd like to open the questions now to our audience, and before doing that, just to ask that that please keep your comment or question brief and direct, so that I can call upon as many of these hands as I can. Okay, I'd like to let's start here with Jeffrey Herbst right here.
Sure, Jeff Herbst. Thanks very much for attending today. I was wondering if you could reflect on the role of foreign observers in elections. Would Kenya and other African countries be better off without observers? Or if there is a role for them, how might they be used most productively.
Roll of four. So we take maybe two questions.
Okay.
So that I'll let you make a note there, and I'll go to the gentleman here in the front row, and then we'll move over to the left side of the room.
Thank you. My name is BMJ Murith with the Voice of America. Mr. Odinga, you are on record as saying that even if the Supreme Court upholds President Kenyatta's presidency, you may not recognize that presidency. I just wanted you to see if you could clear the air, and especially because NCCK, which is the Church Council body in Kenya, has been advocating for the creation of the post of the Prime Minister. Is this something that has your blessings as a former candidate for the presidency? Thank you.
All right, we'll take, I'll let you address those two questions, and then we'll take more from this side of the room.
Well, the role of international observers, you know, following the elections of 8th of August, the Kenyans were very disappointed by the role of international observers, the kind of remarks that they made in quickly giving a clean bill of health to a process that they had not seen through. We had a meeting with the members of the observer team, the leaders, and gave them a briefing of what had transpired. But we saw quite a bit of reluctance on their part. Their minds were made up. You know, what had happened was the elections had two components. One is the polling day. So you look at the day, the time the polling stations were opened, the voting, the counting of the ballot at the polling stations, all that process was very, very transparent. There were no problem about that at all. I can see in the audience here my friend Keith Jennings there. He was of NDI.
Mm-hmm.
They are there and can confirm what I'm saying. The problem was after the results were announced at the polling stations, what happened? The transmission to the tallying center at the mm-hmm. constituency and to the national tallying center. That's where there was a problem, serious problem. Because that's where the results which came from the polling stations are not the ones which are being added at the national tallying center. So they are completely adding different results which they had generated themselves. So he said, what the point in people waking up in the morning, lining long queues, there's rain, there's sunshine, and then in the end that vote does not count. It's something else that is being announced. And we were able to show them evidence which we received from whistleblowers within the IBC that the people had hacked into the system and had posted different results. We even had some log sheets. When we showed them, the concern was more of, how did you get this information? This is confidential information. How did you get it? They are more concerned with how you got it rather than that we had it. That was evidence. The observers, and then they were very quick to come up with, you know, in glowing terms, calculating the Electoral Commission, for organizing a very flawless electoral system. Kenya's leading Africa in electoral democracy. Kenya's example should be emulated. The losers should go to the court or accept and move on. Those are the, so he said that if this is the kind of observers that you have on the African continent. Africa can do without this, because they are more part of a problem than the solution. So in our view, we are very disappointed in the manner in which they conducted themselves at that time. What you have said about the Supreme Court ruling, you have not said that you will not accept the Supreme Court ruling. You said whether the rule that who is elected or not is not going to be a solution to the problem. Because what is the point in having a president who is not recognized by more than half of the country? It would just be a problem. And that is what it is. So you say that we need to have a solution beyond just the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court declaring the, because first, the turnout was less than 30%. That means that there's 70% of the country that does not recognize the president, and that is a problem. The other one is this issue of NCCK proposing amendment to the constitution to create a position of the prime minister and so on. We are not just looking for jobs, the prime minister. That is a very cheap way of looking at it. We are talking about we want to address this fundamental issue of governance. That's why we are saying it cannot be a quick fix. Oh, they're making noise because they are in the cold, give them a job. No. The way I've been for the last 5 years, I've never gone to the government to beg. They've refused to give me my pension as a prime minister that I'm entitled to. There's an act of parliament which entitles me to certain things. Even security, they withdrew my security 2 months ago. They just called them and took them away. When I was still a candidate, they withdrew all my security. But I don't even care. I've hired my own private security. Look at. No, I think it's a very cheap way of looking at it.
Okay. Okay. A few hands over here. Yes, sir. We can bring a microphone.
Yeah, my name is Edward Manyibe. I'm a professor, Langston University, Oklahoma. And I was here in town, and I heard that you are here. And I said I have to come and... So I don't have really a question, but in a very personal way, thank you for the contributions that you've made towards the process of democracy in Africa, in Kenya in particular. And as we see what's going on in Kenya right now, I know everybody is concerned. I meet people asking me all the time. And one thing I'm for sure is that you are a very rational man, and I think that something will come out that's really good for Kenya. So mine is to wish you the engagement that you have here in the USA and the engagements that you have in Kenya to be a very peaceful process, and so that we can move forward. We don't want to go backwards. Thank you.
Let's go over here to this gentleman on the right, right. Mr. Noyes.
Hi, Honorable Odinga, thank you very much for your comments. Alex Noyes here. I'm a senior associate here with the Africa program at CSIS. My question goes to the role of the police. When you were prime minister, there were several reforms that were passed, including the creation of the National Police Service Commission and the Independent Police Oversight Authority, NPSC and IPOA. Can you say a little bit about why you think these institutions have been unsuccessful in reining in the role of the police in institutional and in political violence, and what needs to be done moving forward to do so? Thanks very much.
Okay, reining in the police and moving forward, and then because you've been, there's a gentleman back here who's been standing the whole time, that qualifies you for
all right, thank you.
And asking a question.
Thank you very much. My name is Ali Badawi, and I'm one of the many Kenyans who's been living in the DC area for a long time. I'm part of a local community radio in the region. And my question to you, Prime Minister Raila Odinga, is that talking about the creation of a People's Assembly to address issues of most Kenyans who've been marginalized from the political process, where will the Kenyan population in the diaspora be included? Because as you know, in the Constitution, Kenyans were given the right to vote in the diaspora. And of course, the current regime, you know, like made sure that that did not happen in most parts of the diaspora. So please tell us how you're going to involve Kenyans in the diaspora, especially in relation to the question that Jeff asked about the role of monitoring bodies like the European Union and the Carter Center, because they gave the election a clean bill of health. And after the Supreme Court overturned the election, they were not able to give a comprehensive reason why they gave a clean bill of health to the election. So my question rests on, where will the diaspora come in that People's Assembly? And when can we start forming our own People's Assembly in the diaspora, like the different counties are doing it in Kenya?
I have to say that no session on Kenya would be complete without reference to the diaspora. So thank you for that. Honorable Odinga.
Yes. First, the other one was Professor Maniva was just a comment. Mm-hmm. Then the next one is the
role of the police.
Police, yes. Police. Yes, we did. This is one of the agenda four items. Agenda four were items which were identified by the Kofi Annan-led mediation team in 2008, areas which required some reforms. Remember, it led to the formation of first the post-election violence team led by Justice Krigler. The other one was Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission. The other one was electoral reforms and so on. So this was the other one, institutional reforms was one of them. And we came up with a process of police reform, which itself first entailed setting up an independent police service commission, which was independent from the civil service commission. Mm-hmm. And then there's also independent police oversight commission, which is that commission that deals with ensuring that the police actually do their work properly, independently. They do the work of supervision to ensure that there are no excesses in the police force. First, there was need to transform the police from a force to a service. Remember, we did have, under the colonial system, we had a police force. And the colonial police was a police that was trained by the colonialists to rule the natives. So it was a very authoritarian, anti-people police force. Now, it was never tamed. And like you go to a place like in Tanzania, they transformed it to a police service, which was now, in other words, the servant of the people. But in Kenya, the police attitude remained exactly as it was during the colonial days. Like, see, if you're in London and you lose your way, you go to the police and you ask him that, excuse me, sir, excuse me, can you show me the direction to Trafalgar Square? And you tell, oh, Trafalgar Square? Yeah, walk straight on, turn right. About 300 meters, turn left, walk straight on, you can't miss it. Then you say, thank you, then you say, thank you, sir, we salute you. In Nairobi, you lose your direction, you go to a police officer, and you ask him that I've lost my direction, can you show me how to go to Kariakoo? The first thing is, where's your ID card? If you don't have it, that's a crime. You're arrested, you're handcuffed, you find yourself in cells. Tomorrow you find yourself charged in a court of law, loitering with the intention to commit a felony. So see, this is from the old colonial days. So this was to be transformed into a service, and the process had started. Unfortunately, it was never completed, and it's stalled where we left it. And then under the Jubilee, there's been an attempt to cancel the games. In the past, when we left under the law, the new act, the Police Service Commission was appointing the inspector general, nominated inspector general, and one name is submitted to the president, who then forwards it to parliament for approval. Now they have changed the law, come up with an act which now gives the president the power to appoint and sack the commissioner, the inspector general of police. So we're back to where we were before. So that independence is no longer there. But it has been said that the intention was to ensure that the police are not under direction of politicians. Right now, the police are being directed by politicians. Mm. And this is a problem. That's why the reforms have told. Okay. Now, regarding the People's Assembly. Yes, we are having the chapters locally, but we have not excluded the diaspora. Not excluded the diaspora. And if the diaspora can organize themselves, they want to have an input in what is going to be discussed in the country, that is an idea which will be very welcome. General, I don't think that there will be any opposition to having the diaspora chapter of the assembly.
Okay. I've got a little more time here. I have one final question for you, but let me.
This lady, she raised her hand for too long.
Who's right here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Dr. Mena Demasi with the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. So thank you for your courage, for being here. I was one of the election observers with NDI on August 8th. And speaking independently, I know at a micro level there were things that worked not so well and some things that did work well. So you can talk about things like the color-coded box that led to stray ballots, the same presiding officer waking up at 6 a.m., the same one counting the ballots in the evening. And then you can talk about sort of at a macro level, these institutional reformations that need to take place, whether with regard to the IEBC or more transparency overall. Where are the glimpses of hope for you in this process? I mean, you've been here before. From your perspective, I mean, where you see a resurgence of millennials and young people playing a role here, we know there's change needed, but where do you see progress happening relative to running in the past?
Say that again. Where do you see what? Where do you see?
I want to go ahead and answer that, and then I have one.
Let's see what the final question. The final question. What do you say?
For me?
Question. What is it? Question. What is it? I didn't quite understand.
The. What's that?
Yeah, what exactly is her question? I didn't.
Your question just very.
So my question is basically from your perspective, going back from 2007 to what we experienced on August 8th and October 26th, we know. Clearly there are problems, but where do you see progress happening, whether at a micro, whether it's the level of increased voting participation, what on part of the people, where does the resistance movement see relative progress compared to before?
In other words, I don't want to take the words out of your mouth or paraphrase what you're saying, but what progress can be identified in terms of the actual running of elections, the actual conduct of elections in Kenya, or can there be, or is there progress?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you can call it progress, progression, and regression. Because each time each election has got its own peculiarities, different from the other. In 2007, you know, we were all manual. Everything was manual, coming from various constituencies. But you compare that to 2002, which was the most open democratic elections that has ever been held since the introduction of multipartism. In 2002, the results were being broadcast live on live television from polling stations to constituency tallying centers. That worked very well. In 2007, they were doing the same thing. And they had finished most of constituencies. There were only about 50 constituencies left out of 210. And then they sensed the danger because we were leading by over 1 million votes. And even if Mr. Kibaki had gotten the bulk of those 50 remaining, he could not cross bridge the gap. Then they ordered all television stations to stop live transmission. So the live transmission was stopped. Mm-hmm. And now they're only announcing that Mr. Odinga is still leading, but Kibaki is fast closing the gap. Plus closing the gap. And then in the end, they announced the result that Kibaki had won, and nobody believed it. The country imploded. The consequences you now know. The last time around, the result was supposed to be electronic. This was supposed to be an improvement on the manual, because the manual one, they just went to the National Intelligence Service headquarters summoned all those remaining returning officers to take their results there, and they were doctored at the headquarters of the intelligence service. This last time around, they had the server, two servers. One was at the intelligence headquarters, the other one was at the commission headquarters. Then they had a system through which they're getting results at the national headquarters, at the intelligence headquarters, doctoring, then forwarding to the main server at the electoral commission headquarters. So you could say it's an improvement in terms of rigging. Now the rigging went digital. It's still rigging all the same. The same with like this last time round. The server this time is in France, the cloud in France. And they were supposed to be transmitting directly to this portal in France and then to the National Telling Center and also to the constituent telling centers. But they never did. The reason why Safaricom, the service provider, is involved in this and is one of the victims of boycott, because they colluded in that process of transmission of results and cheating. And that's the reason why their names have been put in the list of the boycotts. So until we get an electoral commission which will be prepared to do the right thing, the result as they have come from the polling station are the same results that are transmitted to the constituency and also to the National Tallying Center, we will still be having this problem. See, it's because it's just a different level of cheating. And as long as you've got an electoral commission that is willing to be compromised by the national intelligence, you have this problem. So it's more complex. We must get a situation where the national intelligence is removed from the electoral system so that they don't become part of cheating. Then Kenyans will be able to get leaders that they deserve.
Well, we have come just about to the end of our allotted time, and I know there's still a lot of questions out there. I think I maybe would like to conclude with one question from this chair. Some wise Kenyans have reassured me recently that yes, Kenya may be in a political crisis, but do not worry because Raila and Uhuru are going to work this out. And they are in conversation with each other, and all will be well in the end. And as I joked to you earlier, I recall Uhuru Kenyatta and Raila Odinga sitting on the sofa of the ambassador's residence back in 2005 as friends and allies who were jointly working to deal with the machinations of the then President Mwai Kibaki's state house and the executive overreach, and had remarkably similar views on what the new constitution should include and how it should be drafted. So, Honorable Odinga, I guess my final question would be, what would it take to rekindle that that spirit of 2005?
Yes, 2005, 12 years away. But we worked very closely together. At that time, remember, KANU was an official opposition party. And I was in the government. I was then the Minister for Roads, Public Works, and Housing. But I played a very important role in getting Kibaki where he was. And Uhuru was now the official leader of opposition.
Mm-hmm.
KANU was lost. They were not used to playing the role of opposition. They are more used to being in government for many years.
Mm-hmm.
So when this opportunity arose, I reached out to KANU to ally with us. And because we were then in the process of trying to get a new constitution for the country. And the Kibaki elements were actually opposing some very fundamental changes which were popular with the people. Like, for example, they were opposing devolution. They did not like devolution. They were more for a centralized, a unitary system. Then the other one was the issue of executive, the structure of the executive. They wanted to have a pure presidential system. But the more popular version then was the parliamentary system.
Mm.
Parliamentary system, because argument is that in a society that is ethnically torn, a presidential system enhances ethnicity, that people don't feel secure unless they have got their man at the top. And if the man is not at the top, they feel excluded. And it's also a winner take all. So the compromise was a hybrid, the French system, where you have a president and you have also a prime minister, who is also a head of government. And the executive is also in parliament, like the Westminster type. In other words, you've got ministers who are also members of parliament and who can be asked questions in parliament and can answer questions. So the situation is different in a big country like United States or America, because people deal more with the state governments other than what Congress is saying up here or what the Senate is doing up here. So we got Uhuru and KANU to be on our side in fighting for that referendum.
Mm.
And he was very much part of us. But when the election time came, the issues arose now that if he was going to run in his constituency against Kibaki, the interest, he had no chance of being elected.
Mm.
And that's why we agreed that he would run on KANU rather than on ODM, because he was one of the founder members of ODM.
Mm-hmm.
But he knew that he could not be elected as an MP in central Kenya, where the Kibaki party held sway. So he said he would go and run on KANU, and we would meet up front. And things turned out we had the problems. And he ended up on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So
but you're saying he owes you one then. That's
yeah.
Okay. I'm afraid we have run out of time. I want to begin by thanking all of you for coming today, and thanking you all as well for your continued interest in Kenya. I want to assure you, Honorable Odinga, that pretty much everybody in this room continues to be deeply interested in Kenya, and I'm sure they would I'd like to join me in thanking you for spending some time with us this morning and wishing you.
Thanks for joining us for another curated conversation from CSIS. Tune in next week for more. And remember, you can explore all of our events online at csis.org.